Before we get started with today's episode, a quick shout out to my friend Jack Greiner, who was the lawyer who helped vet all of the scripts I wrote for my other podcast, Accused. Greiner's a lifelong Cincinnati Reds fan, so he and fellow Stan Randy Freaking have launched a podcast called We Love Our Team. Each week, Randy and Jack interview Reds fans about their allegiance to baseball's first professional team. Guests have included sports analyst Kirk Herbstreit, former ESPN anchor Betsy Ross, and Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Pureval. Their guests share stories and memories about their Reds fandom. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. This is going to be one of those episodes which, after you hear it, you're going to wonder why you've never heard about this crime. More specifically, you'll wonder why you never learned in American history class about this chapter of a long-term campaign of domestic terrorism that damn near started a second civil war, how it included likely more than 200 bombings across the nation, many nasty public confrontations, death and maiming, as well as almost ruining the great Clarence Darrow a decade before he could go on to work on the Leopold and Loeb case and fight for science during the Scopes monkey trial. You will wonder how this one escaped you. But I'll tell you what I wonder. How the hell did the highest profile and deadliest bombing during that campaign, the one that brought much of the ongoing strife to a close, get forensically solved in an era where it took 3 days to get anywhere by train? The bombing of the Los Angeles Times in 1910 took place when escalating violence against employers that would not allow unionization to succeed was rampant, when the Times was virulently anti-union, when unions decided that because their cause was righteous and meant to ensure that all boats could eventually rise, that it was fine to sink a few first. Between 1906 and 1910, it's estimated that more than 110 ironworks, railways, bridges, construction sites, and workplaces were dynamited in order to get employers to the table to talk terms with those they employed. When those who had no power wanted to wrest control from those who had all of it, they wanted to frighten them, cost them money and time, persisting with repeated attacks to show that the anarchy would not end until employers yielded. It was a pitch battle between those who had little against those who had much, and dynamite seemed the only tool the least powerful had to right the scales. It was effective in some cases, not so much in others. The bombings were mostly small, the news of them appearing in papers sporadically with little fanfare and less follow-up. You can see why the crisis wasn't immediately seen for what it was. There wasn't a lot of communication between locales, so law enforcement coordination was almost non-existent. If it was a campaign, it was a silent one. Not a lot of Americans knew what was happening. The individual bombings made dents, cost money to fix, but sometimes, most times, not at great expense, and business went on as usual.
If you look at the newspaper front pages, if there is a story about a bombing, it's in the lower right-hand corner, and it's continued much further back in the newspaper. It's like it's no big deal.
That's Michael Digby, an arson investigator who was with the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department for 42 years. Digby's also a man who has diffused more than his share of bombs, and he's a student of the temperature-changing, awareness-raising LA Times bombing. The explosion that rocked the mighty granite fortress that housed the Los Angeles Times happened early Saturday morning, October 1st, 1910. The newspaper at that time was run by one of the loudest and meanest anti-union publishers in the land, and easily the most powerful man in Los Angeles, a city that was itself a bastion of anti-union resistance. The bombing remains one of the worst crimes ever committed in California history, killing 20 and injuring at least 100 of those in the building and in the street and bars nearby. It is still the worst crime ever committed against American journalism. It took some planning and some organization, but it was, in its barest form, just one guy with dynamite, fuses, and a cheap alarm clock. Crimson Centuries is sponsored by Ritual. Hey, I just started something new from Ritual. It's called Stress Relief, and it's supposed to lower your cortisol levels first thing in the morning, which I know I need. I'll let you know how that goes. Meanwhile, let me remind you about Ritual and Symbiotic Plus, a 3-in-1 supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic that aim to support a balanced gut microbiome. Ritual and Symbiotic Plus support the relief of mild and occasional bloating, gas, and diarrhea, and a very tasty, easy-to-swallow minty pill. The mintiness is really nice. No refrigeration needed, so it's easy to take with you when you travel. These pills are rigorously tested and validated by a third party for allergens, microbes, and heavy metals. Ritual has multivitamins too, and those are vegan, non-GMO, project verified, gluten and major allergen free, certified B Corp, and made traceable. There's no more shame in your gut game. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to help you celebrate, not hide your insides. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/COTC. Start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/COTC for 25% off. The Los Angeles Times stood in a mighty brick and granite building on a handsome corner lot, though that hadn't always been its home. The first had been located near Spring and Temple, where the Times had been housed since its 1881 launch. The newspaper grew quickly, though, and soon needed more space. Historian Marques Vickers on his YouTube channel.
The second location of the Los Angeles Times building was constructed in 1886 on the southwestern corner of West 1st and South Broadway streets in downtown Los Angeles.
Photos of it from the Times show massive arch windows overlooking the road below. It seems too beautiful, too stately a building to target. But then the target that day wasn't really the building as much as it was the Times owner, General Harrison Gray Otis. Otis was born in 1837 in Ohio, the descendant of a colonial political activist named James Otis. That elder Otis had helped formulate the colonists' grievances against the British government in the 1760s. According to Britannica, James Otis might have been the actual guy to coin the oft-quoted phrase, "Taxation without representation is tyranny." In short, the Otis family name was well respected by the time Harrison Gray came along. According to a biographical index card stored in the California State Library, his parents were Stephen Otis and Sarah Dyer. Harrison Gray fought in the Civil War, hence his nickname General, though his eventual obituary would state he, quote, attained a captaincy and was breveted Lieutenant Colonel of Volunteers for gallant and meritorious service throughout the war, end quote. After the war, Otis was official reporter of the Ohio House of Representatives in 1966 and 67, and foreman of the government printing office at Washington in 68 and 69. After that, there was a stint in the U.S. Patent Office, then in the U.S. Treasury in charge of the Seal Islands of Alaska from 1879 to 1881. It was in 1876 that Otis became editor and general of the Los Angeles Times.
And Harrison Gray Otis was rabidly anti-union.
This is journalist Doug McIntyre on his talk show nearly 10 years ago.
And I know folks would find that shocking that at one time the LA Times was an anti-union paper and the city of Los Angeles was really the most hostile to organized labor of any community in the country.
McIntyre was interviewing Lou Irwin, author of Deadly Times, a well-researched and engaging book about the bombing that was published in 2015.
The Times was the voice of anti-labor in the United States. And it built Los Angeles just on that basis, cheap labor.
That was largely thanks to Harrison Gray Otis, who Irwin explained in a separate interview was
the terror. But very interestingly, he had spent half of his life, more than half of his life, up until he was in his 50s, as just this itinerant going from town to town, working at various newspapers, just a complete vagabond, really. Mm-hmm. And came to Los Angeles, bought a piece of the Los Angeles Times when its circulation was 500, and built it into the most powerful organization in the city. And really, the city was built on the Los Angeles Times.
Now, Otis had been in the Civil War, serving under Rutherford B. Hayes and William McKinley, men who would later become the 19th and 25th presidents of the United States. He would often don his uniform, complete with medals, and walk around the newsroom shouting orders at his reporters and editors as if this was war and he demanded absolute compliance with his orders. He would insist on referring to the LA Times building as the fortress. Soon, so did everyone else. In 1886, when Otis first took control of the newspaper, he was named both editor and general manager. In short order, he co-founded the Merchants and Manufacturers Association, the MMA for short, a consortium of business leaders who wanted to keep Los Angeles union-free. Besides, the city was growing now. It needed to be welcoming to those who built downtown offices and crafted home developments. It needed to build a harbor so that ships could dock and unload all of the goods that were about to turn Southern California into Southern California. That required cheap labor, willing capitalists, and singular devotion to the cause. Otis knew if he could control labor, he could do anything. So he editorialized, lambasted, and shamed anything union in the pages of his newspaper. He especially wanted control of the LA Times because, through it, he could make the rest possible. In 1890, he decided to take on the Typesetters Union, a group he had once been a member of. They were making demands, and the other newspapers in town had yielded. But Otis decided to widen his crusade, casting about the entire country for those who would take their place without union representation. He found them, and almost on a daily basis, editorialized that he was winning this war and wrote, in August of that year, quote, "We are now independent of these people," end quote. Unionists weren't taking this lying down, and a 20-year-long fight between the American Federation of Labor and the Times really got going. The union called for a boycott, and yet the Times, by 1905, was making, in today's dollars, about $35 million a year. Los Angeles, by then, was in an ugly battle with San Francisco. According to author Irwin, LA was referred to as, quote, "Otis Town of the Open Shop," end quote. San Francisco was a closed shop town, which means if you weren't part of the union, you could not work in that kind of job, offering better wages and better working conditions for all. Prices of goods and services rose as well. California wasn't big enough to support such contradictory economic models. People wondered how long the two cities could keep this up. Otis, as was his wont, responded by getting nastier. Lou Irwin again.
Forget about, you know, trying to organize at all. They rounded up hundreds of people who were engaged in picketing, put them in jail, set the bail so high that they couldn't get out. Mm-hmm. And it was a terrible tragedy for these, for the families of all of these hundreds of unionists.
The workers had been asking for a 50 cent an hour minimum wage. So you can see why the unions decided to target Otis's pride and joy. Up to now, union bombers, egged on and paid for by union leaders, had tried to work in ways that wouldn't kill or maim workers. That meant they would strike at night when no one was about, sometimes with the bombers even warning on-duty night watchmen to vacate before havoc ensued. On the night of September 30th, 1910, Otis was in Mexico on some official thing or another. His son-in-law, Harry Chandler, assistant general manager at the paper, had promised his wife that he would leave early that night, a relative thing given his hours. Usually there past 1 a.m., he did leave early, around 12:45. It was a typical big city news night, but the newsroom and editorial departments had already handed their work over to the usual assortment of typesetters and printers and headed out to a few of the bars that were adjacent or across the street from the fortress. One night editor was staying late to send the results of a race to New York. Another editor was staying to finish up some paperwork. Some workers noted the smell of gas on the first floor and complained to others that it was strong enough to make them sick. At 1:07 that Saturday morning, 16 sticks of dynamite blew apart most everything standing at the corner of First and Spring Streets. The bomber had entered Ink Alley next to the building, opened the valve to the gas line nearby, and made sure petroleum-based ink barrels that newspapers use in copious quantity were also close by. Bomb Squad Detective Mike Digby explained what happened next.
When a dynamite explodes, that's a high-explosive supersonic blast that, without any surroundings, is just going to be a cone of explosive material going upward and outward. But if you put that inside of a structure or next to a structure, anything close to it is going to rupture, cave in, blow up, and so on. When you start adding caustic chemicals like the printer's ink, or if you start adding the gas from the building, that's the incendiary effect, and you've got a fireball that's moving at supersonic speed. So it's more than just the blast. Now you've got a thermal effect occurring.
Author Irwin would note that the explosion was seen and felt miles away, incandescent for hours in the direction of the downtown sky. That's what 50 pounds of dynamite does. Never forget that this was a daily newspaper. There were people inside, still working. Most were hurled about, crushed by falling debris, some becoming fireballs running towards safety before collapsing. Some were simply incinerated. If possible, they tried to get out, searing their hands on superheated cables, grabbing at anything to get away from the fire. Some jumped from the building as onlookers urged them not to. Flaming tar-like ink sprayed even onto those who were in the street or in nearby bars. Police and firefighters arrived, a few of whom would end up among the dead and injured that day. In a brief, sort of funny aside, the first police officers to arrive were two undercover cops dressed as women who had been on a stakeout trying to attract a serial rapist. They momentarily confused those who arrived after them. Harry Chandler, the assistant general manager slash owner's son-in-law, came back downtown, surveyed the scene, and by 4 a.m. gathered up any journalist he could find. All of them, to one degree or another, burned, bruised, temporarily deafened, and very, very pissed off, and took them to the offices of the Los Angeles Herald. Chandler had, at some point and without any fanfare, bought many shares of the competing newspaper, which fortuitously allowed him to set up shop there and produce an extra edition that morning. Helped along by the injured employees, as well as a former reporter, now a judge, some theater folks, and a postmistress, Chandler geared up the Times auxiliary press a few blocks away, and the sun was barely up over the San Gabriel Mountains when the headline of the Los Angeles Times read, "Unions bombs wreck the Times, many seriously injured." It's a rather gaping journalistic leap he made there, not unnoticed by union sympathizers. Still, the truth was plain. Someone had tried to stop the Los Angeles Times from printing. They had killed people, they had injured many more, and they had demolished a granite building that had filled the city block. But as for stopping the paper from coming out, well, in that, they failed. Just 2 months before the deadly Times blast, the iron workers in LA had decided to strike, and law enforcement responded. Almost 500 men were arrested as a result, with Otis letting his readers know what he thought of the Union men. As Irwin wrote in his book, quote, "In a single news article concerning the arrests, the Times referred to the Unionists as rowdies, loafers, blackguards, hoodlums, roughnecks, cowards, firebrands, agitators, and jail flutters," end quote. L.A. was hot, and not just because it was August going into a dry fall. John J. McNamara was the secretary-treasurer of the International Union of Bridge and Structural Workers. 2 years earlier, the fancy union man had begun intimidation bombings and used his unpolished, belligerent brother, James B., to do a lot of the work. JB, as he was called, had a frequent collaborator named Ordy McManigal, a good family man who made good money, but didn't think too hard about his work. Still, he was one of the bombers who made sure night watchmen were warned. JB then, for the reason that he had no such empathy, was assigned alone to the LA job, one that differed in a bit, in that it wasn't some building under construction or a random bridge girder or some local plant. Workers were going to be inside that building. Not only that, but this bombing was also going to include two additional bombs being hidden in the bushes just outside of the homes of Otis and his MMA co-founder, Felix Z. Handler, in order to kill them. The bombs used were relatively simple devices. You got yourself some dynamite, easily bought at various quarries, then rigged it with something the bombers called infernal machines. A dry cell battery, some mercury fulminate, which is the dangerous, unstable explosive stuff in detonators, some wire, and an 89-cent Junior Tattoo New Haven alarm clock. You then attached it to your dynamite or your nitroglycerin, set the alarm clock for the assigned time, and, well, boom. McManigal, well-versed in the devices and in obtaining material for the bombs, would help JB gather materials for this job out as far as Omaha, where he'd been given another assignment. McManigal was to circle back home to Chicago, after which he was sent out to a half dozen more bombings all over the country that first week of October. After a stop in San Francisco, JB arrived in Los Angeles on September 29th and checked into the Baltimore Hotel using an alias, which was part of his bombing MO. The next day, he made a trip to the Times to look around under the guise of inquiring about a job. That night, he planted his bombs at the homes of Otis and Z Handler. Then he sauntered over to the fortress, opened the gas valves, and took the back route to Ink Alley, leaving a ticking package behind. Then he got the hell out of town on a 9 p.m. train. Hours later, the Times building blew apart. Eight hours after that, Mrs. Z Handler fortuitously did some morning gardening and found a package in her bushes she didn't recognize. It was ticking. Upon a neighbor's advice, she called police who dismantled it. It had been set to go off earlier, but had been wound too tight. The Otis family found their bomb at 1:45 p.m. and called the cops, who began to dismantle it when the alarm sounded. They immediately threw the bomb far into the street, where it blew a wide crater and broke windows throughout the neighborhood. Meanwhile, union leaders were livid, given the instant condemnation by Otis and other newspapers that unions were responsible. They even sent their own special team of dynamite experts from the mining union to inspect the site. On October 28, 1910, the California State Federation of Labor released a report that there had been no bomb. The cause of the explosion was a gas leak. They would be proven wrong, but union leaders and members all down the line held their ground for almost a year. This was not the union's doing. By the way, I found YouTube videos in which people still make that argument.
The story that comes to us from Los Angeles involves what many of us believe was a false flag operation at a building called the Los Angeles Times. They hired out of the anarchist movement and people who had skills in sabotage to create a number of false incidents that embarrassed and gave the other side great reason to get great publicity against working people.
But back in 1910 LA, no one was listening. By midday on that first Saturday, an enraged Los Angeles mayor put up a reward and made a call to a very famous private detective to find out exactly who had done it. William J. Burns, so renowned an investigator that he served as the first chief of the Secret Service, was called in. The William J. Burns International Detective Agency in Chicago just so happened to have also been retained to look into an early September 2010 bombing in Peoria. A side note, if you're a longtime Crimes of the Centuries listener, you likely recognize Burns' names from past episodes. His security firm, now Burns International Security Services, still exists, still stands as a sign of safety on your premises. Now Burns, who was promised a reward of $100,000, took the LA job on the grounds that he reported to no one and that every lead he found was his to investigate. Burns found nothing much to work with at the bomb site. Most everything had been incinerated. But the Z-Handler bomb was intact. It's dynamite marked as a product of Giant California. This was crazy luck. Explained Digby, dynamite wasn't easy to come by.
So few places sold it legally, and basic police work is all those guys had. They had to do interviews. They had to go through the remains of a blast scene and pick out small parts. They knew to expand the area in which to talk to people. For instance, when the bombing occurred in downtown LA, they did a wide area canvas of all the hotels in downtown. That's not necessarily something that would happen today because we have phone tracking technology. But what they did is they expanded it and they just happened to walk into the front lobby of the Baltimore Hotel at 5th and Main. And that was a considerable break in the case by finding the bomber's name on the hotel ledger.
That name was J.W. McGraw, an alias, it turned out, but it was at least consistent with a name that Burns had seen before in a previous investigation. Also on the case was Earl Rogers, a big-time trial attorney in Los Angeles who was the inspiration for the fictional Perry Mason. The mayor brought on Rogers and offered him most all of the Los Angeles Police Department and its investigators as help. Rogers had seen the damage at the newspaper building before the day had dawned. He had huddled with the chiefs of police and fire, the mayor and Chandler. The atrocity of it stuck with him. This case, as you can imagine, did not want for news coverage, so much so that by Sunday, reporters in San Francisco had already gone to the dynamite plant in Giant, a little burg near the city's East Bay, and talked to the owners. Burns and Rogers weren't far behind, having taken a sleeper car north that Saturday. At the start of the week, the reward was rising, eventually reaching 500 grand. Here's what they found. The Giant Powder Company sat at the eastern edge of San Francisco Bay. Two men, a man calling himself J.B. Bryce and another called Matthew Schmidt, were staying at a boarding house run by a woman named Lena Ingersoll. The pair were tasked with gathering supplies, and they knew they would need a 16 to 24 foot boat to use for a few days. The next day, an ad ran in the San Francisco Call that read, "Wanted, by party of men, 16 to 24 foot launch for 10 days to cruise around bay and tributaries." The ad was sandwiched between other items in the miscellaneous wants column, including a restaurant looking for goats. The men then ordered up 10 crates, or 500 pounds of dynamite. Only 50 pounds would be used in downtown LA on October 1st. The rest was for when more persuasion was needed. Well, it turned out if you order dynamite, the powder company had to know the name of the boat that it would be loaded onto. The two men sent to get the explosives, one had a noticeably bad crossed eye, rented a boat in Oakland, which required lengthy conversations over several days with the boat's owner, who was adamant that one of their captains accompany them. The pair refused that, paid twice as much deposit from a big roll of bills, took the name of the boat Pastime, and decided they'd rename it for use in their chores. To accomplish that, they visited a hardware store to buy new aluminum letters to spell out Peerless. Then they set to changing the name in clear view of people in the harbor, leaving the P from Pastime in green paint. They did a lot of their work from the boarding house, which had thin walls and a busybody innkeeper. Once on the bay, the men struggled to maneuver the boat, causing many to stare as they motored into San Francisco, where they rented a horse and carriage and hauled their crates to a home they had just rented. People watched as they unloaded. The next day, they took their boat out again and, when they needed gasoline, they hired a teenager to look after the boat. A snoopy kid, he looked around, making notes of the ropes, twine, and burlap lying about. When it came to get their boat deposit back, they were handed a check which caused all kinds of consternation about how to cash it. They managed, but not without a lot of other people getting involved. Step by step, investigator Earl Rogers traced backward from the dynamite, across the bay to the boat, from the boat to the rented house, to the boarding house, to the hotel where the men later moved. From the hotel, and I'm really simplifying here, investigators found calls to a cafe where they found that the pair were there quite frequently with Olaf Bietmo, a San Francisco labor boss. Around that time, the guy who rented the house to the pair of ne'er-do-wells in San Francisco decided to check in on them. He found some crates, saw some funny-looking candles, and soon the dynamite used in L.A. was connected to the house. Inside that house, Rogers and Burns found a small piece of paper with Vitmo's initials on it, along with a handwritten, "I'll do it." They also found a map of the L.A. Times Alley and a route around San Francisco Bay. And the boarding house matron, slash Snoop, was convinced to start talking. Rogers kept the newspapers apprised of all his good sleuthing, which ticked off Burns, who headed east to find McNamara. Unlike Rogers, who was talking to reporters constantly, Burns went radio silent. After 4 days of drinking and reading news accounts of the tragedy, JB thought more bombings were in order. His brother JJ told him to lie low. JB met with his sometime co-bomber, Ordie McManigal, who was appalled by the LA death count. JB wasn't. But he was getting very antsy and began thinking he needed to hide out. Unbeknownst to him, however, that inkling came a tad late. By now, his every move was being followed by William Burns, as well as Burns' son and some well-trained trackers. Three of his trackers decided to pretend to be hunters and befriended JB and Ordie in the northernmost woods of Wisconsin where they had gone to hide out. As an anxious JB drank, Burns' boys waited patiently, gathering information to hang everybody. Burns was after the big fish. He was sure this was bigger than one bombing. His agency had, after all, been hired to look at that one in Peoria the month prior, and he was certain both were part of a concerted and ongoing terrorism campaign run by men in suits and ties. On April 12, 1911, JB and Ordie were arrested. The next day, Ordie confessed everything to Burns. A week later, JB's brother JJ was led away from his Chicago office in handcuffs. Clarence Darrow didn't want to take the McNamara brothers' cases at first, despite his well-established reputation as a defender of unionists. Because of ill health and his wife's financial misjudgments, Darrow was in dire financial straits. So when the Iron Workers Union offered him a $50,000 retainer, about $1.5 million in today's money, he said okay. But it was not okay. Author Irwin.
He took the case and came to California and saw immediately that there was no defense.
Darrow's only hope to win this case? Maybe bribe a jury member or two. Accused later of setting out to organize an elaborate effort to do so, Darrow feigned ignorance. On December 1, 1911, after 6 weeks of testimony, J.B. McNamara had no choice but to plead guilty to avoid the death penalty. In the ensuing 2 months, 54 union leaders across the country were arrested. 38 of them would eventually be found guilty on charges relating to the Los Angeles Times case. In January, Darrow was arrested on 2 counts of jury tampering. The man who had given $4,000 to a juror in McNamara's case at the behest of Darrow had turned state's evidence. In mid-August 1911, Clarence Darrow rose to his own defense in the bribery case. I'm no Darrow, but I'll quote, "What am I on trial for, gentlemen of the jury? I am not on trial for having sought to bribe a man named Lockwood. I am on trial because I am a lover of the poor, a friend of the oppressed, because I have stood by labor for all these years and have brought down on my head the wrath of the criminal interests in this country. Whether guilty or innocent of the crime charged in the indictment, that is the reason I am here, and that is the reason that I have been pursued by as cruel a gang as ever followed a man." End quote. He spoke to the jury like that for 6 hours. People cried, and the case was deemed a mistrial, saving, for now, Darrow's law license and his reputation. By his side that day, sitting as co-counsel, was Earl Rogers. A year later, Darrow would face a second bribery charge, of which he was acquitted. His early biographers maintained his innocence. Those who examined the case later did not. It's still up for debate in some circles. For a time, the tide turned against the labor movement. Letters to the editor showcased a sympathy for the cause, but horror at the deaths of innocent people who were doing nothing more than working when they were killed by a conspiracy that had forgotten who it served. But industrialization in this country ramped up and workers began, again, to fight for leverage and gained it. Los Angeles grew by leaps and bounds because of it, but that night remained forever a steep price in the growing. Arson Detective Digby again.
And there's a lot of first responders that don't come out of it unscathed. A lot of firefighters, a lot of people in the bars, which of course were a bunch of newsmen, but people that were in the area on a Saturday night, they didn't come out of that unscathed. There's lots of people that had not just physical injuries, but never actually got over it. There's a fireman by the name of Lieutenant Ernest Rhodes, I think that was his name, for the LA City Fire Department. And he was so torn up about this that decades later, just before he retired, he wrote a letter to the LA Times expressing the troubles that he's gone through for the last 30 or 40 years, never really getting over the sights of what he saw that night or heard that night, people dropping from the buildings on the sidewalk right in front of him.
J.B. McNamara died in San Quentin in 1941, never having expressed remorse for his crime. Burns became a legend. Rogers was immortalized as Perry Mason. Darrow grew famous. In Los Angeles's Hollywood Forever Cemetery, there is a plaque and a monument to those who died that day. The remains, unable to be identified specifically, were gathered in this one place and entombed. The plaque in part reads, quote, "This imposing pile, reared by the Los Angeles Times, stands here to perpetuate the names, the virtues, and the memories of those honored dead who in life toiled in the ranks of the journal which they served so long and so well, and who fell at their posts on October 1, 1910. Victims of conspiracy, dynamite, and fire. The crime of the century." End quote. It goes on for 6 more paragraphs, listing the names of those killed that day. It ends with a dash, the number 30, and another dash. That's the traditional code to all journalists and wire services that the reader has reached the end of the dispatch. For this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read Lou Irwin's book, Deadly Times, The 1910 Bombing of the Los Angeles Times and America's Forgotten Decade of Terror. She also read many retrospectives on the case in the pages of the LA Times and spent time with the topic on the Library of Congress research site, Los Angeles Times Bombing and the Dynamite Conspiracy. Special thanks to arson investigator Michael Digby for agreeing to an interview with Amy. Crime Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.